Order. And right away, I'm going to announce that on today's schedule, we had work sessions planned for House Bill 2111 and 2343. I'm carrying over House Bill 2111 to the Wednesday, April 5th committee meeting. And I'm carrying over House Bill 2343 to Wednesday, April 5th meeting. We have several members that are testifying. Well, we have two members that are testifying in other hearings right now, so I'm going to move into the public hearings and open a public hearing on House Bill 2756, 2757, 2764, and 3166. And Representative Holvey, are you ready? Do you want to present from up front?
Mr. Chair, I will just kind of go over basically what the bills do from here, and perhaps there will be other people that can speak more specifically to it.
Shall I invite the representatives from the Department of Energy up in case they have questions?
Certainly. They could probably answer questions probably better than I.
Okay, I'll invite Todd Cornett and Mike Kaplan up then.
So thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Paul Holvey, State Representative, District 8, speaking. And though many of you have heard, and some have closer connection to it than others on this committee, that we did conduct the Department of Energy Oversight Committee. As has been noted, there was not a formal consensus output from this committee. However, there were several issues that the committee generally on the record agreed with, and I'll speak to that. And of course, I'm going to speak first to House Bill 2756. As we looked at the Department of Energy, we did note a lot of the past problems with the Department of Energy came from their management of incentive programs and caused in at least some major part by the legislature of not providing the direction nor the parameters of making these types of incentive programs work, and certainly not providing them the expertise and the resources to the expertise to do that kind of financial underwriting for loans and managing portfolios. So House Bill 2756 moves the SELP, the Small Energy Loan Program, to Business Oregon Development Department with a minor continued role for ODO on project qualification. The Oregon Business Development Department will conduct underwriting, portfolio management, and establish performance measures for the project, measures to be developed jointly with Oregon Department of Energy. This bill narrows the scope of how loans are dispersed and ensures that funds are going to the best uses by requiring the Oregon Business Development Department to conduct a study to determine commercial needs for loans for small-scale local energy projects, and certainly to make sure that those loans don't cause undue risk to the state of Oregon or this particular portfolio. If performance measures are not met or loan payments are not made, the loan is immediately due and payable, and directs the Business Oregon to prepare a plan for addressing program deficit with a report back to 2018 session. There is a direct $3 million from the general fund to Oregon Business and Development Department to carry out the program. And I'll just leave that bill at that. Would you like me to walk through the next bill?
Please.
Briefly?
Please.
House Bill, next one is House Bill 2757. They make sure I've got the right bill. So House Bill 2757 establishes a task force on the Energy Siting Facility or Energy Facility Siting Council. The current FSEC process process is a standards-based review, which requires that if standards are met, a certificate must be issued. This process, as we learned in our oversight committee, created a lot of frustration for citizens trying to participate in this process. And it's a very complex process, and we decided that there should be a task force to look at how to improve this this process to better have public input primarily, and also to clarify some other issues. And we think this is a conversation that is a much larger conversation that needs to look at the cost recovery formula and several other things around FSEC. So really just trying to get a better conversation around the FSEC process in the future that we may come back and consider at a later date. House Bill 2764 has to do with the energy supplier's assessment. The current exemption from payment of the energy supplier assessment is $250. House Bill 2764 raises that exemption level to $2,500. It seems like a large increase, but really has, you know, impacts a small amount anyway at the bottom end of that. I think it largely is meant to help some of the very smallest energy suppliers in dealing with this assessment. I think that's a pretty straightforward a bill. That's another one. It was a difficult conversation to talk about the energy supplier assessment for a lot of reasons that have come about, but this is one that we thought was pretty straightforward, pretty simple, and shouldn't be too controversial, at least so far. So that's the three bills before you, 2756, 2757, 2764. And I'll let somebody else speak.
I'm going to invite the department to make some comments next. But I did want the committee to know that HB 3166 is kind of a gut and stuff amendment of 3166, in that the amendment simply rolls 2756, 2757, and 2764 into one bill with the amendments that Representative Holby mentioned all together, so that if we find facility in passing just one bill out as a committee, we can do so. But otherwise, there's no substantive changes. So with that, I'll invite the department to make any comment you'd like to make.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, Michael Kaplan. Even though I don't sound like it, I assure you it's me. I wanted to start with just to introduce Todd Cornett, our assistant director in charge of the Energy Facility Siting Division. Let him take on that bill, and then we'll testify on the two additional ones after he finishes up. So with that, Todd.
Good afternoon, Chair Helm, members of the committee. As Director Kaplan said, my name is Todd Cornett. I'm the assistant director, or one of the assistant directors, at the Oregon Department of Energy, and I manage the Energy Facility Siting Division. I'll keep my testimony fairly brief today and talk about some of the elements of the House Bill 2757, and certainly can answer any questions you may have. I submitted written testimony as well, and that goes into much more detail. House Bill 2757 is composed of two major parts, task force and a statutory change related to cost recovery. First, the task force. This consists of four individual components, the first of which is to review what constitutes an energy facility, as that term is defined in ORS 469-300. The importance of this definition is that it establishes which type of facilities fall under the jurisdiction of FSEC and what the thresholds are for each one of those facilities. So this component is really about evaluating the jurisdictional thresholds of what can come to the Energy Facility Siting Council. The introduced bill included all 12 types of energy facilities within jurisdiction of FSEC. The Dash 1 amendments reduce that to four types of facilities. These are solar PV, wind, geothermal, and solar thermal. This reduced list represents much of the projects that we've been seeing and expect to see in the near future, rather than the entire list. The second element associated with The task force is ways to improve public participation in the siting process. Like Oregon's land use system, the State Energy Facility Siting Review is designed to include robust public participation. Since 2012, we have been committed to enhancing public participation by pursuing numerous projects and changes, most of which are listed in my written materials. We've come a long way in enhancing public participation in our process, and we recognize that we have a long way to go. We welcome any new ideas that would come out of this task force. Number three of the task force are ways to expedite the process for reviewing a site certificate. Similar to the public participation component, we have pursued numerous projects and changes since 2012 to increase efficiencies in how we review applications and amendments. These are also listed in my written materials. And again, we welcome any new ideas that would further increase our ability to efficiently review these applications. The final component of the task force is recommendations for defining or clarifying the term single energy facility. This relates to when two or more energy projects that are individually too small to be within state jurisdiction, but based on a host of factors such as ownership, proximity, shared facilities, actually function as a single project that could or should be considered within state jurisdiction. The introduced version of this bill proposed to evaluate the single energy facility question in relation to geothermal and wind energy projects only. The Dash 1 amendments add solar PV projects to this list. This is because there are increasing numbers of solar PV projects both at the state level and the local jurisdictional level, and we have already been receiving numerous inquiries about this very question. The second major part of the House Bill 2757 is the statutory cost recovery formula for general costs associated with the siting division and council. These general costs are referred to in statute as those costs that are necessary to ensure that all approved energy facilities are being operated consistently with the terms and conditions of site certificates, any orders and applicable health and safety standards, but that cannot be allocated to an individual licensed facility. Currently, the statute requires site certificate holders to pay an annual assessment that is comprised of two components. The first is the full cost of the forecasted compliance activities associated with that facility. The second is the general cost component, which are those that cannot be allocated to an individual licensed facility. The statute limits the general cost component to be no more than 35% of the total annual assessment. Therefore, the higher or lower the compliance costs are for a facility for a particular year, the higher or lower costs of those general cost obligations. The bill proposes to eliminate this formula in statute and replace it by another formula, which would be established in Oregon administrative rule by the director of the Department of Energy with a statutory directive to apportion the general costs of the council and department among site certificate holders. That concludes my prepared testimony. I would be happy to entertain any questions that the committee may have.
Committee, do you have questions of either the department or Representative Holvey? Representative Pence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious why the narrowing down of the energy facilities to which the discussion would apply. It was the 469.300, and it was narrowed down dramatically. What was the? Is there something to be gained by narrowing it down?
Chair Helm, Representative Benz, the narrowing down simply given the time associated with the task force, each one of these types of facilities has those who are in favor of them, those who are against them. There are significant stakeholders associated with each one. Going back to the 2013 session, or prior to the 2013 session, it took, I think it was a House committee, the entire time of reviewing just solar PV to get through an actual proposal to change the solar PV thresholds. So looking at all 12 types of facilities, all the different types of thermal, biomass, it would be a very, very big task within that time frame to try to tackle all of those different types of energy facilities.
Follow up. Thank you. So The concern that I heard expressed really wasn't so much on those specific facilities as it was on the lack of the ability to appeal a decision once made. I think the focus was on the lack of an appropriate record and then the inability to get a decision that one could appeal to the Supreme Court. It was that point of the process that was the focus of at least a great deal of concern. Would that come up in this arena that as now suggested in the amendment? Because that was what I heard people wanted to discuss.
Chair Helm, Representative Benz, yes, absolutely, would still come up. So the first component of the task force would be evaluating the jurisdictional thresholds. So for solar PV, is 100 acres on high-value farmland or 320 on other land sort of the appropriate threshold? That's the kind of aspect that we would be looking at under the first element. But if you look at the second element and talk, which is ways to improve public participation, there is no change within the -1 amendments to alter that, and I believe that's where that conversation would occur.
Follow up.
Yeah, I just want to make absolutely sure whatever we do, we don't focus on a whole bunch of talk about the issue that wasn't one that I heard. What I heard was a very, very high concern that there was no way to take one's the outcome of the decision and appeal it, that there was a gap there, primarily driven by the fact that there's a bias toward establishing linear projects or others that say it's going to happen, and there was no particular good way to argue about it, and that's therein is the problem. But I want to make sure that the task force has all the time in the world, to the extent the task force has it, to address that kind of an issue. How much time does the task force have? When's the report due?
Chair Helm, Representative Benz, I do not have the bill right in front of me. I believe it concludes in December 18, if I recall correctly.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the report is due September 15, 2018, and the task force sunsets on December 31st, 2018.
Thank you. Thank you.
Further questions?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What input have utilities had in this process? Were they consulted? Did they have input into what you put forth here or what's in the bill?
Chair Helm, members of the committee, Representative Johnson, this bill is directly out of the Joint Oversight Committee process. It's actually not the department's bill. There was a year-long engagement process. So that's where these suggestions come out of.
Okay. The department wish to testify on the other bills?
Chair Helm, yes, right we would ahead. Like to. excuse me, for the record again, Michael Kaplan. Consistent with both the governor's direction and a variety of the recommendations that came out of the joint oversight process, House Bill 2756 moves the SELP program from the Oregon Department of Energy to Oregon Business Development. Over the life of the program, SELP has financed more than 900 projects in every county in the state, financing more than $600 million worth of energy projects. Unfortunately, between 2007 and 2010, several risky loans were written off, resulting in losses of more than $30 million. When I took over at the Department of Energy, we calculated that the deficit from those losses that had accumulated in that program were around $16 million. In the last 3.5 years, however, the good news is we have taken a number of administrative functions to reduce that deficit from $16 million to $8 million. This bill will bring that deficit down by another three. SELP loans are funded via proceeds from general obligation bond sales. The program uses loan revenue to pay for its expenses. The program has never been capitalized and has operated without general fund support since its inception. The House Bill 2756 with the -1 amendment envisions quite simply a lift and drop of the SELP program. The loan portfolio, the revenue it creates, the staff, the positions that we currently have unfilled, the FTE in that regard would all be lifted out of the Department of Energy and dropped into Business Oregon. It also makes several administrative changes. First, it eliminates the CELPAC, which is an advisory body to the SELP program and replaces it with Business Oregon's existing Infrastructure Finance Authority Board. The second is the removal of appeal rights for denied SELP applicants to go directly to the governor. That allows for Business Oregon to maintain complete control and accountability for the program. It will also require Business Oregon to conduct a study about the need for SELP in today's market. It needs an update given that the commercial lending has largely, in some measure, filled in to where SELP had been effective in the past. The bill also ends the Energy Efficiency and Sustainable Technology Loan Program, which has been dormant for some time now. And the bill also transfers $3 million from the Alternative Loan or Alternative Fuel Vehicle Revolving Loan Fund. Again, this is the mechanism that I talked about just a second ago that will further reduce the deficit, take it down to around $5 million. And lastly, the bill appropriates $3 million of general fund to Business Oregon to run the program. And that's all we have on 2756. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Questions, committee members? Okay. All right.
Okay. Finally, House Bill 2764 relates to the energy supplier assessment. The energy supplier assessment is a fee used to provide revenue to the Oregon Department of Energy that's assessed to energy suppliers throughout Oregon. This bill raises the exemption floor of those assessments from $250 to $2,500. The amount assessed for each supplier of energy is based on a ratio between the total gross operating revenue earned in the state between all suppliers and the individual energy supplier's share of that total amount of revenue. The ESA for this biennium, to give you some context, is about 11 cents out of every $100 of revenue. So this math isn't absolutely precise, but for if you earned at least $200,000 in revenue from the distribution of energy in Oregon, you would be subject to an ESA assessment of about $250. This bill raises that revenue earned number from about $200,000 to $2 million. So you would not be subject to the assessment unless you had earned, again, the math isn't spot on, but unless you had earned $2 million from the sale of energy in Oregon. Had the floor been, had the floor been $2,500 this biennium, it would have exempted 9 energy suppliers. And I think there is a chart provided, and if it hasn't been posted yet, it will be in the near future, I'm sure, that has a spreadsheet with this information calculated to the dollar that will be available to you. The bill does not impact that the revenue that the department will collect. It merely impacts the number of payers and how much they're paying. Be happy to take any questions.
Questions on this bill. Representative Reschke.
I actually had a question on the 2756, if that's okay.
That is okay. Go
ahead. All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just had I'm new, so forgive me if I don't understand the terms lift and drop, in the sense that I'm curious, is the headcount remain the same? So if you're lifting a program out of one department and putting it in another department that does execute loans and has that expertise, is which I'm assuming is going on here, then is there any efficiency gain? Do we lower headcount because we're already doing a lot of the administrative function of managing money that way?
Chair Helm, members of the committee, Representative Reschke, presumably. However, in this case, we have already reduced the amount of people working on SELP over the last 3.5 years, the idea being to do everything we can to cure the deficit. So right now, we have 8 or 9 FTE approved for the program. We only have 3 positions hired, 2 accountants and 1 loan officer to sort of manage the program. So we're at the bare minimum, and that's allowing us to reduce the deficit overall. Mm-hmm. However, lift and drop, we'll be lifting all the approved FTE, including those positions that do have people in them, and offering up them to Business Oregon. Business Oregon will have to make decisions about how they want to staff it going forward, if they want to staff it either more or less. It is my assumption, although I'm not going to speak for Business Oregon, they do have the efficiencies. You know, they're more experienced lending operation than we are. So I'm pretty confident that there will be efficiencies they can gain. However, because the staff is already so low, they're still going to need a person to manage the portfolio. They're still going to need 2 accountants to deal with the bond servicing and the loan servicing. So they're sort of both true, I guess, at the same time.
So
follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there is a potential that you say you have like 8 or 9 FTEs currently in the program, but you're only staffed at 2 or 3. And when you transferred over, you're transferring all 8 and 9 to Business Oregon, so they could ramp back up to the full 8 and 9. Is that correct?
Chair Helm, members of the committee, Representative Reschke, that's exactly right. I think contingent on the results of the study, if there is actually a need for SALP or potential adjustments that could be made in the future to make it competitive and to make it to a viable lending tool again, they could ramp back up with the positions that we'll be sending them, or through their own existing positions and their own existing staff. I think both could be viable outcomes.
Okay, thank you for that explanation.
Further questions? Representative Holby.
No, just perhaps a point of clarification that Mr. Kaplan can respond to. You know, I think as the Oversight Committee looked at the SELP program, it's currently not making loans. And when we look at that deficit and we look at the history of the SELP being really a pretty successful program outside of one or two big bad loans that maybe shouldn't have been made. And so just keeping that in mind, if Business Oregon's got good parameters around financial underwriting and managing this loan portfolio, they may come to the conclusion at some point that the market is right for us to start making those SELP loans again. And by doing so, that income stream could help pay down some of the deficit, or, you know, which, you know, is going to impact the general fund. So that was sort of the thinking behind moving this to Business Oregon, leaving the options open for Business Oregon to actually start making loans again when they saw the financial conditions and market conditions were ready to do that.
Chair Helm, to that end, members of the committee, Representative Holvey is absolutely right. We have been able to work down the deficit through administrative changes. So, in other words, not funding the staff certainly takes it down. We've also recently completed a bond refunding, essentially a refinancing of the bond debt, which further reduced the deficit. With the $3 million that is transferred from the Alternative Fuel Revolving Loan Fund, that takes it down to around $5 million. Depending on what interest rates are in the future, there's a chance for further refinancing. And if Business Oregon decides to stand the program back up again and is able to create revenue through additional loans, there's a high likelihood that this deficit will never actually hit the general fund. That's certainly a possibility, a stronger possibility today than it was 3 years ago, for sure. So Representative Holby's right. There is SELP was incredibly successful for a very long period of time, beating commercial lending performance, with the exception of a handful of essentially speculative venture capital between 2007 and 2010 that went very poorly and dragged down the entire portfolio and the program with it. Obviously, we think that there's a good chance that it could be more successful in another agency.
Very good. Well, thank you both very much for being here.
Thank you very much.
We'll invite Paul Romaine and Gary Bauer. And just by way of information, I think we had allocated to about 3:45 to get these bills done. So if you could help us with that, I'd be appreciative.
We will be very brief.
Excellent.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I'm actually authorized to speak on behalf of all the utilities. And we just more or less had a question. We think some of the transfers and some of the stuff you're doing here are fine. It's what money is being transferred to Business Oregon? And we heard Mr. Kaplan say no general fund money is being transferred over or being used for the program. Is ESA money being used for the program? Because we have been told in past conversations that ESA basically backfills all programs at the department. ESA is a tax, in spite of some people who may disagree. And again, that is being litigated currently. So we just have a concern. If ESA money is being transferred, it's supposed to be dedicated to the Department of Energy. If it's not, we don't have a problem. But if it's not being transferred over, then we don't have a problem. But if it is being transferred over, we do have a major problem with it. So I guess we'd like to ask that question, if you would ask that of the department. It would bring a comfort level to us and others in the back of the room.
Okay. What I'm going to do is go ahead and get Mr. Bowers' testimony as well, and then either Representative Holvey can answer that question, or we can invite the department back forward.
Thank you, Chair Helm, members of the committee. I'm Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural. My comments are focused just on the Energy Facility Siting Task Force that was just discussed.
Okay.
And I'm also speaking on behalf of Varner Siemens and Portland General Electric. Varner's in another hearing at this point. Both Portland General Electric and Northwest Natural have significant investments in facilities that are subject to the Energy Facility Siting Council process. As such, we have a little bit of a concern about the wording around the makeup of the task force. It's five members of appointed by the governor, people who represent interests of persons affected by the energy facility siting process, which is quite broad. One could argue that's every citizen in the state. We have significant investments. We work with the Siting Council. We work with the Department of Energy. We go through how their process works is very important to us. We understand the need for public involvement. We actually, when we go out and do a project, we hold open houses and do our own level of public involvement. So understand the need for public involvement, but want to make sure that the those of us who are kind of have these investments with the Siting Council and the state have a place at the table. Thank you.
Good. Any questions of these two individuals? Thank you very much. And
well,
do you want to answer the question? Sure.
Well, yeah, I would probably defer to the agency to handle the question. It's my understanding that the money is being transferred to the program being transferred to Oregon Business Development does not include transferring ESA monies. So you may want to ask the department for further clarification on that. And as far as the FSEC, I would assume that there will be some utility input on something like that. I have no opposition to, making that more pointed.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I'll invite Mr. Kaplan back forward to answer that question.
For the record, Michael Kaplan, there is no ESA being transferred. SELP is completely self-sustaining, so its revenue off the loan portfolio pays for its administration, the staff. There won't be any money moving to Business Oregon from the energy supplier assessment.
Very good. Thank you. And unless there's any other comments or questions on these four bills, I'm going to close the public hearing. Okay. I'm closing the public hearing on HB 2756, 2757, 2764, and 3166. So, committee, I think at this point I'm going to go to the public hearing and work session on House Bill 2072. And Beth, can you tell us what's going on with this one?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2072, for the record, it would extend the sunset on all of the biomass tax credits until January 1, 2024. There is a -1 amendment available on OLIS that transfers authority for the woody biomass portion of the biomass production or collection tax credit from the Oregon Department of Energy to the Oregon Department of Forestry and caps the total amount of allowed tax credit for woody biomass at $600,000 per year. There's a revenue impact issued and a fiscal impact issued available on OLIS. And this bill does have a subsequent referral to the Committee on Tax Credits.
I'm going to, at this time, invite Amanda Dalton and Heath Curtis forward. Just when you need her, huh?
Yeah, she's everywhere.
Do you want to start, Heath, or do you want to wait for...
I can start.
Okay.
That's fine.
Very good. We won't get too far.
Great.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, my name is Heath Curtis, and I'm with the Oregon Forest Industries Council. And in full disclosure, my role today was a supporting role in saying I, too, support this tax credit. With Ms. Dalton entering the room, I'm glad to see I'll still be able to perform that role.
Should we start?
No.
Do you want me to start first?
Please.
Chair Howland, members of the committee, Amanda Dalton. I'm here today on behalf of Biomass One, and we are a biomass facility, a 30-megawatt biomass facility down in White City, Oregon. We're here today to talk specifically about woody biomass and offer our support for House Bill 2072 with the -1 amendment that is on the list. So just a quick reminder, I know you heard a lot about woody biomass last week during the joint hearing. Woody biomass is one component of the larger biomass category, which includes organic plant and animal materials. Woody biomass is the limbs, tops, needles, leaves, and other woody parts grown in a forest, and the most common source of biomass-based electricity is wood. And the most common method of converting biomass to electricity is through direct fire combustion. Oregon has approximately 17 woody biomass power facilities, the majority of which produce both heat and electricity. These cogeneration facilities are often built alongside sawmills and other timber facilities to also utilize the heat they're generating on site. Woody biomass supplies a constant, distributed, and economic energy supply that is renewable and that provides important and unique environmental benefits. Examples of these include reduced risk of destructive wildfires by recovering woody biomass from the forest floor and improving our forest health and reduced consumption of landfill capacity. In addition, as you know, Oregon has recognized the use of biomass as an energy resource that reduces greenhouse gas emissions, and it is included in the RPS as a renewable energy source. As you've heard, we believe there is an economic benefit to woody biomass. Production of renewable energy and biomass collection provides an economic opportunity in rural Oregon by putting to work underutilized material. The current challenges, and really why we're here today, and while there's still a need for this tax credit, is that biomass removal is not without its challenges, stemming largely from location. Generally speaking, forest biomass is the highest cost material that any biomass facility uses. And this stems from several issues, including access challenges on winding and sometimes steep forest roads, the distance of timberlands with clean biomass to the biomass facility. For example, Biomass One collects in southwest and central Oregon, and our fuel sourcing area has increased by approximately 90 miles just in the last 2 years. In addition, this is labor-intensive work of collecting and grinding woody biomass in often rough terrain. This collection credit helps to offset these high costs, expanding the working circle where biomass plants can access materials. Specifically to the -1 amendments, we recognize the current budget situation and competing voices, especially in the renewable incentives world, as well as the joint comments made during the Department of Energy reorg interim committee about the needs for parameters and policy objectives attached to renewable incentives. And to that end, we hope to work with this committee and other stakeholders to continue this discussion during the interim to reshape and revamp our renewable incentives. However, we do believe an extension is important today to ensure continuity and support of existing and new investments as it relates to woody biomass, and hope you will support the -1 amendments. And the -1 amendments really do three things. It separates woody biomass from the general biomass tax credit. And if you saw in the Department of Energy handout that was on OLIS, you'll see that this is fairly significant because the biomass tax credit, I think, is in the $4.5 to $5 million range. And the woody biomass is really about 600,000 of that. So we're not talking about a lot of money, but a fairly significant amount of money for a growing renewable energy source. So it does separate the woody biomass. It also moves it from the Department of Energy, who I'm sure you have heard or have seen all at OLIS, does not want it or no longer would like to support it. And it moves us to the Department of Forestry. It extends the cap to 2024, kind of the norm 6 years, but with that commitment to continue to work during the interim. And it also caps the tax credit at $600,000, which is based on the 2015 usage data that was provided by the Department of Energy. And with that, Heath is glad to answer any questions that you may have.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, again, for the record, Heath Curtis and the Oregon Forest Industries Council. OFIC represents Oregon's larger timber landowners and most of its forest product manufacturers. We're here testifying in support of House Bill 2072 and, in particular, the -1 amendments. As we see it, if you're going to be incentivizing renewable energy, which this state does in abundance, we think that biomass is a pretty good one. It's carbon neutral. It creates jobs largely in rural areas. It leverages low-value residual wood products that would otherwise be left on the forest floor or burned at the mill, not for energy purposes. It allows us to improve forest health. It reduces the need for prescribed fire. That is to say, if you're going to burn slash piles out in the woods, that's going to be a lot less controlled than if you're using it with scrubbers and technologies at a biomass facility. And it reduces our reliance on fossil fuels. As Amanda said, I think that the parameters in the Dash 1 amendments appropriately confine this program and allow you to define it to going forward, and it moves it into an agency that should be able to handle it going forward. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, but we think it's a good bill. You know, the legislature has lots of questions to ask itself about the degree to which it wants to incentivize different energy sources. We happen to think this is a really good one. For biomass facilities, really, this incentive allows them to reach a little farther away from their facility in order to get those forest residuals. And whether you think that's good policy or not is your choice, but we think it is and would encourage your yes vote.
Questions for these two? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a clarifying question. How is that $600,000 apportioned? Are we talking dry ton, wet ton? What's the formula for how?
Yeah, so it's $10 per Chair Helm, Representative Johnson, it's $10 per dry ton.
Per dry ton. Thank you.
Any further questions, committee? Representative Holder.
Thank you. So I assume from listening to the discussion that I'm just preempting this question from others, that there will not be any ESA monies being transferred with this program when it goes to the Department of Forestry if this bill were to pass?
Chair Helm, Representative Hovey, respectfully, I don't even know what ESA monies are. I would defer to the Department of Energy.
Well, it does fund this program currently in the Department of Energy, and the governor's office has seen fit, as you may know, to weigh in that she thinks all these incentive programs should sunset in cost-saving measures for the Department of Energy. So I'm sure the energy suppliers will be very interested to find out whether or not the assessment is being left alone.
Chair Home Representative Hovey, as will I.
Amanda, do you have any insight into that?
Chair Helm and Representative Holvey, not specifically outside to say that I think that the revisions that you made to coal to clean in 1547 and prioritizing biomass as renewable make it one of our priority renewable incentives to keep it aggressive and competitive as it competes. I describe biomass as, you know, it's one of the few renewables that has an extra step. You can't just build the solar or put the windmill up. You have to kind of go and collect and then return it to the facility. So we do think it's a good use of the ESA and would ask that it be prioritized.
Follow up.
And just one follow-up question. I'm sure perhaps the Department of Forestry or someone or Department of Energy or maybe the Global Warming Commission has done a study to study the amount of emissions from biomass facilities versus slash burning, for example, or, you know, per ton sort of comparison, so we can see how much emissions reduction we're actually generating from these incentives or from biomass facilities.
Chair Helm, Representative Holvey, I don't know for sure the answer to that question, but if I may, one way I would tackle that is that it seems likely to me that if you burn the resource in the woods or you burn it in a biomass facility, it seems likely to me that the CO2 emissions anyway would be identical. That is to say, you're burning the same product. The difference between the two, to me at least, is that when you're burning it in the woods, there's no controls on emissions of other things, whether that be particulate matter or any of the constituent elements. You know, there's a lot to be said for controlled burn of that product. And so long as you believe that the biomass will either be burned in the woods or it will otherwise biodegrade, I think the total global warming emissions would be very similar. The question for you has to be, if you want to suffer those emissions, where and how do you want to suffer them? We think a biomass facility is a good place to do it. So that's how I'd answer that question.
Thank you both very much. Committee,
We have this scheduled for a possible work session today, but I've got one more person to testify. Bill Kluding, come on up. And if Ivan Molesky is here today, I think he signed up last time. Okay.
Thank you, Chair Hill, Vice Chair Johnson, Committee for the Record, Bill Kluding, Carpenters Industrial Council. House Bill 2072 is a bill that's really needed. My expertise, a lot of years I spent on woody biomass. For well over a decade, I've been with a biomass work group appointed by our governors. Still going, ongoing. I've been on the Federal Forest Advisory Committee since day one, and 50% of the conversation in these two groups is woody biomass. We failed to be able to get any cogen facilities online like we hoped to, but I see a good market for woody biomass, woody pellets. As you know, sometimes in the winter, in some of our rural areas and urban areas, we have to shut off all wood-burning stoves. To some people, this is what they heat their house with all winter. With the facilities we have today and the technique we use with woody pellets, you can burn this in your home and not hurt the atmosphere at all. It meets all standards. I'll make sure I get to you folks the documentation I've been carrying for years on what exactly is in a major forest fire smoke and how much. I'll make sure I get that to you. There's millions of tons, the Biscuit Fire, millions of tons went up the air. All that comes down. With our state is spending millions of dollars, Department of Forestry working with the federal folks on trying to clean up some of this federal land. And I can tell you what goes on in some areas now. Without this tax credit, this stuff will be stacked and burnt. And to me, that's a crying shame. Look, I carry this jobs pin every day. These jobs will be created in rural Oregon. But we need a leg up. We don't need a handout. We need a leg up. And this tax credit does that. It takes some of the burden, some of the cost burden away from these contractors getting this material to a processing plant that can either make the pellets or down south, millions of tons of woody biomass that's been converted to pellets is being shipped overseas. What a market. Those states are making money off this. We could be doing the same thing here and clean up our forests and create jobs. Hopefully we can get this tax credit extended again, and I'll make sure I get that documentation I put together on what's in the forest fire. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Bill? Representative Holvey.
Just a question perhaps to staff. Can the woody biomass tax credit be used to help consumers purchase those pellets that Mr. Kluding is speaking of?
I would need to maybe, Mr. Chair and committee members, I need to, that's not my thought, but let me check really quickly to make sure that's the case. I don't believe that is.
Well, I can get that. I can get that question later.
There is that possibly, because they talk about replacing with other means.
Do you want to say that?
When we get the bill.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I can get that question afterwards.
Okay.
Thank you. So, although I intend to vote on this bill.
Ooh. Well, you do so.
Okay.
If I may, Chair, if I remember right, the original intent of this tax credit for woody biomass was the transporting it from the woods to a facility.
That was my understanding as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Kluge.
Thank you.
Stand at ease for a minute. Let you think.
Stand at ease.
I'm going to stand at ease for a moment. House Bill 2072. And I would entertain a motion on this.
Chair Hill, I move to adopt the Dash 1 Amendment dated 2/28/2017.
Representative Johnson moves to adopt the Dash 1 Amendment dated 3/28/2017. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes. And the amendment is adopted.
Chair Hill, I move House Bill 2702 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference.
Representative Johnson moves House Bill 2702 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I reluctantly will be a no on this measure going forward. I still have outstanding questions as to how this program will be paid for and some questions about emissions and some of the data involved around burning biomass. So I will be a no. Thank you.
Okay. Any further discussion? Representative Pence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be a yes, but I also have questions about the amount of the credit, but I'm happy to serve on the tax credit committee, so I'll have a chance to look at it again.
Very good.
Okay. Representative Barnhart.
I'll ditto those remarks.
Okay. Very good. Seeing no further, Representative Brocksmith.
Well, and I'll be a yes as well with the good Representative Benson and Barnhart on the tax committee to go over the rest of the bill.
It's a lot of trust.
Some are more trusting than others.
And remember, we got this guy too. So, all right.
I'm good.
Seeing no further discussion, will the clerk call the roll, please?
Representative Barnhart? Aye.
Representative
Benson?
Aye.
Representative Boone?
Excused.
Representative
Holby? No.
Representative
Reschke? Aye.
Representative
Rossman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Power?
I'm so sorry. Representative Power is excused.
General.
I vote aye. And just a clarification, we had a typo in our script. And just for clarification, the correct number of the bill is 2072.
Yes, and, as in the agenda.
Yes.
Thank
and
you.
As I stated, as I opened it, I think I got the number right.
You did.
Very
Thank
good.
You.
All right. The motion passes, and the bill is sent as amended to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits. I'm going to move now to a work session on House Bill 2748. And Beth, if you'll remind us.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2748, it modifies sources of money deposited in the Residential Solid Heating Air Quality Improvement Fund. There's a -3 amendment on OLIS that authorizes the Residential Solid Fuel Heating Air Quality Improvement Fund to be used to fund the programs for replacing or removing uncertified solid fuel burning devices, requires DEQ to design a program to reduce emission of air contaminants by providing rebates for the replacement or removal of uncertified solid fuel burning devices. Declares an emergency effective on passage. There's a no revenue impact and a no fiscal impact issued on the bill. And there was originally a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Mm-hmm. Representative Johnson, did you want to say a few words before we go?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, you remember we heard this hearing or had this hearing way back in February?
Very early.
A long time ago.
Yeah.
Representative Kenny Geyer had a bill we heard. She and I have worked together on this. This actually is a compromise bill. She's supportive of this, as well as Representative Greenlick, who is on the original bill. We tried to simplify and separate the two issues. This is strictly policy. There will be a fiscal attempt and a different vehicle that Representative Kenny Geyer will be working on. And I do believe that there are potentially a couple of issues regarding Oak Ridge and some of those communities there that could be dealt with on the Senate side when the bill gets over there. So we will likely see it back for concurrence at some point, but it seems like the most expeditious way is to pass the policy out now. It has broad support, and I think helps significantly to provide some guidance to DEQ on how to manage the program going forth regarding wood stove smoke and what we can do to provide some abatement in those areas that are either non-attainment or could potentially reach non-attainment status. So I think it's a good compromise, and I'm ready to go.
Okay, very good. Any other? So I'm going to go ahead and entertain a motion on this, on the amendment, on the dash three amendment.
Here, perhaps, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I missed that. Sorry, Representative Bob.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was quite a while ago. I'm trying to remember if this is the bill that the mayor of Oak Ridge came and testified on.
It is. Correct.
He was quite eloquent, and I remember his testimony quite well. And if this is the bill, then I understand it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Do you want to do it during discussion? Or?
Yeah. Okay.
I'll entertain a motion on this amendment, please.
Chair Helm, I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendment dated 3/30 of 2017.
Representative Johnson moves to adopt the Dash 3 amendments dated 3/30/2017. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any opposition? Seeing none, the amendment passes.
Chair Helm, I move House Bill 2748 as amended to the floor of the DuPass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral of the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Representative Johnson moves House Bill 2748 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there any discussion? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just speaking of this bill in general and reflecting on the mayor of Oak Ridge and L. Rapa from Lane County, seeing that, you know, I did suggest an amendment that would have provided DEQ some flexibility in the ratio that they use in this bill for 70% needs to be used for wood stove replacement, and, you know, walking through how that doesn't work for a community that is subject to a great deal of poverty, and further, you know, dismayed that the bill couldn't be used for subsidizing the cost of wood pellets for consumers, which would help them make the decision to keep a more cleaner burning wood stove. I'm going to be a no on this bill, and hopefully that situation gets fixed on the Senate side and I get an opportunity to support it when it comes back. But I do feel very strongly that this bill should provide some flexibility to Department of Environmental Quality to consider other proposals that may not adhere strictly to that 70-30 ratio. I think it's only practical to do so for communities that are in that non-attainment area that are also in poverty, where a wood stove replacement program is not the best pathway for them to stay out of non-attainment, which was the testimony from Oak Ridge. Thank you.
Yeah. Any further discussion? Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure where the votes are on this. I think it needs to go to the floor, but I absolutely agree with Representative Holby, and I am concerned that that the bill did not get amended to deal with their particular problem. The mayor expressed himself, I thought, quite clearly in that their approach to attainment was very different from other communities, and this bill doesn't accommodate that.
Okay, thank you.
So my intention is to vote no, unless you need the vote in order to get it to the floor. I would like to get it fixed in the Senate.
Would you like to comment on that, Representative Johnson?
Certainly. I've heard those comments. We've heard that was from Senator Brzezinski as well, and he sits on the committee that this will be entertaining this bill and is pledged to work over there. We just, in the interest of time, needed to get the bill moving and out of this chamber and over that direction. But I would just remind the committee that the only financial resources that will be available for DEQ to administer are going to be voluntary private sector donations and or other non-general fund, unless the other effort in Ways and Means is successful, which I think, again, given our budget situation, is probably a coin toss. So therefore, we need to give some confidence to those folks who have a vested interest in this bill that the majority of these resources will be used in a way that's going to have the biggest benefit, bang for the buck across the state and so forth. So to get too down in the weeds for one particular interest may discourage some of those entities from wanting to be supporters of this initiative. So that's why we elected to keep it as kind of broad as we could at this point. So
thank you. And I'll just comment that I've been involved with Representative Johnson and Representative Kenny Geyer in getting the bill to this point, and I've taken the comments of Senator Brzezinski into consideration. It's my belief that he will seek to change the bill in the way that we've discussed and provide that flexibility that the mayor of Oak Ridge has asked for, and we'll probably see that bill come back on concurrence. Without any further discussion, will the clerk call the roll, please?
Representative
Barnhart? No.
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Representative Boone?
Excused.
Representative Holby?
No.
Representative Rushke?
Aye.
Representative Brossman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Power?
Excused.
Chair
Mullen? Aye. Motion passes, and the bill is sent as amended to the floor. Representative Johnson, would you like to carry it?
Thank you.
This time I will open a work session on House Bill 2760.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2760, you originally heard on 329. It extends the sunset on the property tax exemption for alternative energy systems from 2017 to 2023. There is a revenue impact issued and a no fiscal impact issued on this bill. Also, there was some communication about this maybe being a more appropriate bill for the Revenue Committee.
I would entertain a motion on this bill.
Chair Hillman, move House Bill 2760 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Tax Credits be rescinded and the subsequent referral to revenue be added.
Representative Johnson moves House Bill 2760 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Tax Credits be rescinded and a subsequent referral to revenue be added. Is there any discussion? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I'd simply note that the replaced referral is the correct one.
Okay. Thank you. Further discussion? Okay. Seeing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Excused.
Representative Holby?
I will be a yes.
Representative Rushke?
Aye.
Representative Brossman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Powers?
Excused.
Chair
Hill? Aye. The motion passes and the bill is sent to the Committee on Revenue. Now I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2889. Beth, can you remind us of this proposal?
Mr. Chair and committee members, you originally heard this bill on 315. House Bill 2889 creates a 9-member task force on the secure pipelines to study and report on certain issues. There's a dash 2 amendment that's on OLIS that replaces the measure with the exception of the December 31st, 2018 sunset and the emergency clause, and establishes a 17-member task force on the secure pipelines and associated storage unit and terminals, requires the task force to study and report on certain things, including relevant state and federal safety standards for pipelines, technologies, and processes, how they could be used to mitigate potential dangers posed by a natural catastrophe, cost incurred, and incentives associated. It requires the task force to report its findings to an interim legislative committee no later than September 15th, 2018. and there's a no revenue impact and a fiscal impact statement issued on this measure.
Good. I would entertain a motion on this bill.
Chair Elm, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated 3/23/2017.
Representative Johnson moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated 3/23/2017. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Okay. The amendments are adopted.
Chair Elm, I move House Bill 2889 is amended. To the floor of the due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Johnson moves House Bill 2889 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Bloom?
Excused.
Representative
Foley? Aye.
Representative
Rushkey? Aye.
Representative
Brown?
Aye.
Aye.
Excuse. Aye. The motion passes. And the bill is sent as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you, committee, for getting those done. And now I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 3269. And this is Representative Power bill, and her staff was here.
I just texted her staff. She had to run out. She should be back momentarily. Okay.
Why don't I, in addition to inviting Samantha up when she gets here, invite Angus Duncan and Alan Zelenska up. Like to go first, go right ahead.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Helm and Vice Chair Johnson and members of the committee. My name is Alan Zelenka. I'm a member of the Oregon Global Warming Commission. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today about the Oregon Global Warming Commission, hopefully to rename the Oregon Climate Change Commission, and in support of HB 3269. Oregon needs to take seriously both the impending costs and risks of climate change, and we need to reduce our emissions. Oregon's greenhouse gas emissions, about 80% of which come from energy consumption across all sectors of the economy, were moving pretty consistently downward since 1999, but are now increasing again. The Global Warming Commission, was given the responsibility to address the sources and the responses to greenhouse gases and climate change. While the Global Warming Commission was given the responsibility, it was not given the authority or tools to discharge that responsibility. Thus, we do not have a detailed state action plan to know what are the most cost-effective actions the state should take to lower our greenhouse gas emissions and to meet our targets, and we desperately need one. The Global Warming Commission does not have the bandwidth, staff support, or analysis capabilities to recommend needed mitigation and adaptation strategies. As well, state agencies are uncoordinated in their strategies where they exist at all. And Oregon certainly needs a climate policy and planning function to do this analysis, create the benchmarks, and measure progress towards meeting our statewide goals. Absent the structure to accomplish this work, and for agency accountability, state climate and greenhouse gas policies, such as those that are contained in the Oregon Global Warming Commission's roadmap to 2020 and our framework presented in the report to the legislature in 2017, these policies carry little weight with state agencies to prioritize their work plans, staff, and resources. And for that matter, absent any accountability structure, such policies carry little weight when the legislature sets its agency priorities, FTE, and resources. In the Global Warming's 2017 report to the legislature, we've got copies of it for you, an excerpt of it. The commission unanimously adopted the following three findings. The first unanimously adopted finding was that the state's climate policy machinery is not measuring up to the task of achieving greenhouse gas reduction goals and preparing the state for the effects of climate change. This failure is especially noteworthy for tasks not being performed by rigorous cost-benefit analysis guided by agency assignments and benchmarks and for tracking performance. Second unanimous finding the commission came up with was the commission recommends that the legislature direct agencies to collaborate with the commission to set assignments from the commission's roadmap to 2020 and benchmarks and to report annually to the commission on progress or lack thereof and the reasons why. The third unanimous finding that the commission came up with was the commission should commission further recommends that the legislature provide the commission with modest but sufficient resources, staff and budget, to enable it to discharge its responsibilities in a timely and efficient manner, including its analysis, communications, and tracking functions. So I urge you to support HB 3269, which is a modest but necessary restart of climate strategies in Oregon. It gives the Global Warming Commission modest resources to identify and to prioritize the cost-effective measures and provides critically needed agency coordination with the Commission's climate plan and accountability for moving forward. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Samantha, go.
Thank you, Alan. Chair Helm, Vice Chair Johnson, and members of the committee, for the record, I am Samantha Gladue. I am here on behalf of Representative Karen Power, who is out with a sick child today. She represents Milwaukee, Oak Grove, and parts of Southeast Portland, and I'm speaking in support of HB 3269, a bill which would modernize the Global Warming Commission. Despite existing since 2008 and having a membership of 25, featuring various industry and agency leaders, the Global Warming Commission is not part of common environmental policy vernacular. In part because of a lack of resources, and in part because of the name, this commission has been working largely in obscurity. In sincerity, Rep. Power had not heard of the commission prior to taking on this bill, and neither had several of her professional colleagues. That is significant given her employment and environmental law background. As with most unstaffed commissions, the body is what the members make of it. For the last decade, the Global Warming Commission has primarily worked with the Oregon Department of Energy to meet its statutory obligations. The commission has been successful in chronicling their history, progress, biannual reports to the legislature, and recommendations on a centralized website, keeporegoncool.org. However, it could do much more. House Bill 3269 modernizes the commission by changing its name to Climate Change Commission, as global warming is just one piece of overall climate change, and cleans up statute accordingly. The bill expands duties of the commission to have a focus on better coordination of programs and activities in order to increase the effectiveness of efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. It also has a focus of better coordination with agencies of state government, defining that agencies involved with the commission should establish responsibilities and tasks for carrying out recommendations of the commission. The bill directs agencies to establish benchmarks against which they may measure progress toward greenhouse gas emissions reductions and adaptation and preparation outcomes. The benchmarks would be evaluated as necessary. The bill defines duties for non-voting members of the commission, specifying that non-voting members shall report regularly to the commission on energy and climate programs and activities of the agency or institution the member represents. Non-voting members shall also evaluate and make recommendations to the commission on how best to coordinate state energy and climate programs and activities. Finally, the bill requires the commission to appoint an executive director and appropriates general fund money to the commission for this purpose. Understanding our budget deliberations, the amount of this appropriation is currently left blank to be discussed and determined. We know that's a big risk right now. We are nowhere near achieving our greenhouse gas emission reduction goals. In the absence of a directive to an agency to focus on the issue of climate change, the Global Warming Commission is a tool which can help guide us. It's vital that we maintain and sharpen the commission. I have some experts on the commission here with me today who can tell you more about why House Bill 3269 is important to pass. Chair Helm and members of the committee, Rep. Power would like to hear your thoughts on how we can best modernize and improve upon the commission. Thanks for hearing this bill. I'm going to turn things over to Angus now.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, my name is Angus Duncan. I'm president of the Bonneville Environmental Foundation and chair of the Oregon Global Warming Commission. I'm here in support of House Bill 3269. You've heard me, I think, sufficiently on the general propositions involved in this bill and in House Bill 2020. And beyond that, you've heard from Representative Powers, representative, and more to the point from Commissioner Zelenka on behalf of the overall. So I'm not going to try to repeat all that. I do want to just take the opportunity to reconcile this position on 3269 with my early remarks in support of House Bill 2020. My objective in supporting both of these bills is to create the best possible prospects for effective analysis-based least cost emissions reduction and climate change preparation, and to do so while we and we strengthen a reliable least dollar cost, least environmental cost electrical system, an objective that I have devoted several decades of my professional life to accomplishing, and I think I and everybody else who has contributed to that process and that outcome have a lot to be proud of, frankly. My view is that the best way to proceed with ensuring that climate change issues are dealt with in that constructive, effective, analysis-based way is to connect the Commission with the Department of Energy. But if the legislature, in its discretion, chooses not to go that route, then I hope you will give the Oregon Global Warming Commission the modest toolkit that House Bill 3269 offers us. And just as a postscript, Chairman Helm, I do also hope that our commission would be bringing back to your committee and the legislature later on this spring considerably greater detail on our forest carbon accounting project, which I will align with and I hope inform prospects for forest biomass contributions to both the energy and the climate goals of the state later on. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for this panel committee? Representative Johnson.
I'll go to the newbie.
All right. Representative Brock-Smith.
You want the newbie? I had to go first. Thank you. And thank you so much for being here. Maybe the new gentleman can help me with a question that I've asked everybody that's talked about climate change and the global scale. What is Oregon's carbon emissions compared to on the global scale?
The Representative Smith, the Oregon represents about 1% of the nation's greenhouse gas emissions.
So Oregon represents 1% of the United States' greenhouse gas emissions.
Right.
Okay. This is progress. Thank you. And so when it comes to the, because we're changing the name of the to the global Oregon Global we're changing it to the Oregon Climate Change Commission. Correct. Are you still going to be working on the global climate show, considering that Oregon produces 1% of the nation? So I can almost imagine that if we produce 1% of the nation, that what we produce as far as greenhouse emissions to the globe would be less than 0.5%.
True. It's often thought of that it's a very daunting problem to deal with climate change, that it is a global problem, and Oregon's such a small slice of the globe. But as Bill McKibben once said, there is no silver bullet to climate change solutions. It's really more like silver buckshot. So there's a lot of little actions that add up to a tremendous amount of action and change that can result in tackling the climate change problem. So every little bit along the way, every player has to do their share in order to make up one of those buckshot to make up a large amount of change in getting towards climate change mitigation and adaptation.
Follow up. Thank you. Well, I could appreciate that if, but again, we're 1% of the nationals' output of global or just national output of greenhouse emissions. How much would the proposals, and I unfortunately haven't had a chance to read it, but when we had a meeting last week, I don't know if you attended, I believe Angus was there, Mr. Duncan, it was a $700 million annual figure was mentioned to for Oregon to help reduce its 1% of the national greenhouse emissions. Is that what we're talking about here? That's what was mentioned when we had the...
On an annual basis?
No. Yes.
Representative Rocksmith, I think that was an estimate of what a statewide cap and invest program connected with California would derive for Oregon in terms of a revenue stream from the pricing of carbon.
Correct.
Right. And California is in the upwards of above $3 billion so far in that cap and trade system. Almost $4 billion. Addressing your question more directly, though, if you're familiar with what's called the McKenzie curve, there is a way of putting together all of the actions that are possible on a scale, and this is a copy of the one that's been done for Oregon. It's called the Oregon Greenhouse Gas Marginal Abatement Curve. It needs a better acronym. But what it does is it takes each action and has it done by cost effectiveness. And the very first half of the actions that are on this list are actually net benefits to the state of Oregon, the second half of which are have a net cost. So we can fully get to and meet our targets in the near term by doing almost exclusively, if we had a plan and the resources to do it, by doing almost exclusively projects that are a net benefit to the state of Oregon, meaning that they actually save us money, like energy efficiency, like higher gas mileage and renewable energy. These things are cost effective and will save Oregonians money as opposed to cost. And it isn't until the very far out years, and by then these things may have had technological changes that may make them cost effective, that we would get to those final actions. But right now, we don't have a plan. We don't have a plan that sets forth this cost effectiveness. We just have kind of a guess based on the of what has been done so far by the modest staff that the commission has had.
Follow up, and I know that you have other. I respectfully disagree. I would think that what could save the Oregonians money is a transportation package that can move them along the highways, therefore reducing emissions and getting them from point A to point B, saving them gasoline in the process rather than charging them more to travel on the roads. So I am not only unsupportive of the bill, but adamantly opposed, giving this new commission this broad brush over 1%. That could cost the citizens of this state millions of dollars scares me, frankly.
Chair Helm, Rep. Rocksmith, if I may. Thank you for that. Climate change is a problem which needs a multi-solution approach. So the commission is, of course, not the only way to fix it. Also, for the record, the commission was created in statute in 2007 and started in 2008.
I was just appointed a member of the commission.
Oh, yeah. Yes, so you know. Okay, great. I thought you said a new commission, so my apologies. Super sorry.
I think he's referring to me as a new guy.
Oh,
well,
sorry.
I need to move on to other questions in our final panel, if I could. Representative Benson, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the paragraph, not sure which section, 3, says that all agencies identified by the commission to have responsibilities related to the recommendations developed under this and that shall, as requested by the commission, to max extent practical, coordinate with the commission, too. That list of things, has anyone spent any time determining the cost this would impose upon our other agencies? I mean, I'm assuming that we'll have a climate czar. Not who that czar will be, I'm not sure. But this commission is going to ask agencies to do certain things. I mean, that's the gist of this paragraph. What might we anticipate that is going to cost the state? Because I've looked at the numbers here, I don't see it. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you can start by just telling us what you would ask the agencies to do, and then you can tell us what that's going to cost us.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bentz, the best description of what we would hope that the agencies would do is contained in the roadmap that the commission adopted unanimously back in 2010. We have not been able to cost that out because, frankly, we don't have the resources and capability to do so. We have been able to, through the good graces of some of the agencies and some direction from the legislature, we have been able to take a look at what the relative costs might be for some of the measures. The state transportation, sustainable transportation strategy, which was developed by ODOT with a stakeholder group that I was included in, did take a look at some of the costs and concluded that in a number of cases there would be costs to the agencies, but there would ultimately be economic benefit to the citizens. Electric vehicles is an example of that, where the expectation is that while EVs right now cost more than internal combustion machines, they will cost less as we get down the road, and there will be net savings for citizens.
Right.
But there will be a cost.
There's going to be a cost, and so rather than go off into the hope that this is all offset, just stick with the costs. Do we have a number?
The cost to the agencies.
To the state of Oregon, thus the agencies.
Yeah. No, we don't have that cost. And to some extent, that's going to be something that we will have to defer to the state agencies, how much work they want to do and what they're willing to report back to us. The commission under this bill would not have the authority to tell them what to do or even to tell them what to analyze. We can recommend it and they can respond. But there is deliberately no language in here that would allow our commission to intervene between the department and its commission, between the department and the governor. So,
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that I learned when looking at tax law is that it pays to look at the entire system that you're trying to measure rather than individual components, because in different places the individual components are different. You were asked a question about Oregon's contribution toward greenhouse gas emission, I think, or a question of that effect, and the answer had to do with the percentage of the American emissions. The fact is, isn't it the case that Americans, on a per capita basis, are responsible for vastly more emissions than most of the other people around the world, and that in fact, it's also true, isn't it, that it's only been lately that China has exceeded U.S. emissions with a population about five times our size. So even though United States is only, or Oregon is only 1% of the United States is huge. Isn't that all true?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Thank you. I would also note, Mr. Chair, that the orders to the commission on page 3, subsection 10, I'm looking at lines 2 and subsequently, that the commission is, Oregon must strive not to disadvantage Oregon business as compared to business in other states. And they will, in concert with complementary policies and actions of other states, reduce global levels of greenhouse gas emissions. Now, this is existing language. It isn't new language. But I think it's important to point out when we're talking about the kinds of things that the commission is charged with doing, that this language is there and that it's an important part of the safety net for to protect the ongoing operations of Oregon business while the commission carries out its work. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I do. We got 5 minutes and four panelists. Can we make, is it an easy question?
No.
Go ahead, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence. I guess what I keep coming back to is the driving force behind this bill and other efforts are the carbon reduction goals that were adopted back in 2007, correct? As well, and you don't have to answer because I think I know the answer. As well as, at that point in time, it was the Global Warming Commission that was also adopted legislatively. But what kind of fascinates me is how those carbon reduction goals have become the holy grail that drives so much within this state. And I'm going to segue to another topic here, too. 5 years ago, we passed our 40-40-20 academic goals for the state for our public education system, which our governor at that time called the North Star, by which we would, that would be our target. Everything we would do on funding and policy would be directed towards achieving these goals. There are bills in this session right now that are trying to either water those down or eliminate them completely, but yet we continue to hang on to these 2007 goals. And we've heard testimony in front of this committee from a climatologist at OSU who has said clearly that it doesn't matter what Oregon does, the cake is baked, that the outcomes regarding whatever's going to happen climatology are going to happen regardless of what we do. So I guess I come back to why is it within the purview of perhaps of this global of the Climate Change Commission to look afresh at what we could do as a state and not simply be locked into achieving these arbitrary goals, which I would say they are, and adapting and pivoting to what could be a better response? How could we better help the global efforts to try to achieve carbon reduction? And maybe it's not just sacrificing our own economy upon this, but maybe we get into research and development so that we can help those economies in the world, many of which are still living in the dark, and they're not going to live that way forever. They're going to want a piece of that pie too, as China has, you know, and they're continuing to have a growing economy. So I'm just saying, It seems to me that the cake is baked in terms of what the outcomes and the recommendations are going to be from the commission going forward. Because they're all going to be about what we have to do to reduce, to meet these goals. And I know there's also efforts to even double down on these goals, that the 2007 goals aren't enough. So I'm just saying there could be a better response for the state of Oregon other than simply being tethered to or chained to these goals and saying that's what we have to put upon our economy with all the other impacts that our good senator representative down here is alluding to. So I don't necessarily need an answer, but I'm just saying it just seems odd to me that we aren't thinking creatively about what could be Oregon's best response if to the global carbon problem.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I will try to find some time, Representative Johnson, on your schedule for us to maybe talk about this in a little more detail. You know, I would just say a couple of things quickly. One is, as frustrated as you may be about those goals, having a vice grip around the state's thinking on this, you know, that's how frustrated I am that they are purely aspirational and that there is nothing that is leveraging people to try to meet those. Secondly, we actually are probably going to meet those goals, at least within our electric utility sector, which is our second largest sector. I think proving that with focus, you know, there are ways that we can meet the goals and meet them in a cost-effective way that preserves the reliability of our utility system, and I think we can do the same thing on the transportation side. Third, I would respectfully, I think, take exception to characterizing the Climate Change Research Institute as saying that we don't need to work on emissions reduction. I have never heard them say that. Now, I've certainly heard them say that we need to pay more attention to adaptation and preparation, and I have heard Representative Bentz say that over and over again, and I absolutely agree with that. And one of my frustrations is we don't have the bandwidth to do that yet. And I'll just reserve the rest of the response for later if I can.
Mr. Chair, just quickly. Three quick points. Chair Helm, Representative Johnson, while the targets are old, they are actually consistent with the recent Paris Accord targets that we've seen. So they're still in line, even though that they're relatively ancient in the climate change world. And if it is, if the cake is really baked, that would be a real shame, because it's going to be tremendously more expensive for us to deal with climate change, because adaptation is probably in the realm of 5 to 10 times more expensive than the mitigation would ever be. And although I just respectfully disagree that it's too late, I think that mitigation is very possible, and we can control climate change with appropriate incentives and doing cost-effective measures that reduce greenhouse gases, and Oregon needs to do its share in order to make it happen around the globe.
With that, I'll thank all the three of you for the information you provided for us.
Thank you.
And I'll call forward Paige Spence, Tuck Wilson, and Jana Gastelum. In committee, I thought we were going to make it out of here on time, but
sorry to slow you down.
We're close. We have this panel and then one more person to testify, and then we'll be done. But if you have to leave, I understand.
Chair Helm, Vice Chair Johnson, members of the committee, my name is Paige Spence with the Oregon League of Conservation Voters. I will keep it very quick. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this bill. And OLCV is here on behalf of our statewide members who also support this bill as well. Oregon needs to take climate change issues seriously and address them systematically and do the analysis to really be able to know which solutions will be effective for Oregon, both from a policy perspective and an economic standpoint. And we need coordination among and accountability from all of our statewide agencies that have both environmental and emergency management responsibilities. And presently, as we've heard, the Oregon Global Warming Commission has a lot of that responsibility, but not necessarily the authority or the resources or other tools that they need to be able to carry out that responsibility. We already know the dangers of climate change to our health, our forests, our watersheds, our wildlife, and our economy and our infrastructure. And OLCV believes that House Bill 3269 is a great restart on our state's climate strategies. It gives the Global Warming Commission relatively modest resources to prioritize measures by cost effectiveness and, crucially, provides for agency coordination with the Commission's climate plan and accountability for moving on each agency's share of that plan. For these reasons, I will keep my testimony brief and just reiterate that OLCV very much supports this bill. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Tuck Wilson, a 50-year resident of the state of Oregon. I have served as special counsel for TriMet on its light rail extensions for years and a one-time assistant secretary of state and deputy state treasurer for the state of Oregon. I'm delighted to have an opportunity to discuss with the committee perhaps the most consequential issue of our day, the unrelenting and persistent warming of our globe. Now, I want to concur with the eloquent testimony of those who appeared before you. I want simply to add that there was an extensive study done last year about the state's climate policies and the Oregon Global Warming Commission. I will file a copy of this report by Lewis and Clark Law School with the clerk, and it's available to members of the committee. With that, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Representative Helm, members of the committee, my name is Jana Gastelum. I'm the Climate Program Director at the Oregon Environmental Council. We are here in support of HB 3269. Climate change has been identified as a threat to national security by the Pentagon. The World Health Organization has called it one of the greatest threats to public health. Faith leaders, including Pope Francis, issued the first ever climate encyclical, and they made a moral call to action. The state of Oregon has also recognized it as a threat back in 2007 by forming our goals and the commission. But despite the enormity of this challenge, we're depending on volunteer capacity through the Oregon Global Warming Commission to take stock of Oregon's efforts, undertake new analysis, and make recommendations for charting a path forward. For a problem of this magnitude, Oregon needs to dedicate resources, even if just modest to begin with. The Global Warming Commission has done a tremendous job with extremely limited capacity from forming both legislators and the public about Oregon's actions to address climate change.
But these lack of resources mean that information is often limited and that analysis is sometimes delayed. Relying on volunteer capacity means that research has to be fit in around the edges and that often a full analysis is not completed. Earlier today, Representative Holvey asked a question about analysis that could be done, and I don't think there's a plan for being able to answer that question currently with the capacity and resources that we have. Oregon could help address this problem by adding climate to the mission of the current Oregon Department of Energy through a bill such as HB 2020, and we would support that effort as well. However, if that action is not taken, then HB 3269 rightly provides resources to a newly named commission, and it broadens the scope to undertake additional evaluation to make better recommendations for action the states can take. Equally important, it allows benchmarks to be established and new accountability, new yardsticks for measuring progress towards Oregon's climate goals, and it enhances the coordination role needed for a systematic approach to climate change, both for mitigation and preparedness. Oregon needs a well-researched action plan for moving forward. Providing resources ensures that more questions can be answered, better analysis conducted, and more timely and comprehensive action plan can be evaluated and implemented. And as to the state's goals and why they are important, if your doctor recommended that you needed to lose 50 pounds to stop a heart attack, losing only 20 pounds doesn't safeguard your health. Our goals matter, they're science-based, and we have to reach them in order to safeguard the things that we love, both people and places here in Oregon. Thank you.
Questions for this panel committee? Thank you very much for your testimony today. We appreciate it. And the last person to testify today, Paul Romain.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, one less than started. My name is Paul Romain. I'm with the Romain Group, and I'm here representing the utilities as a group. We decided to just shorten our testimony in anticipation of a short time period to talk and incorporate by reference everything we said on House Bill 2020 last week, if you would somehow put that into the record here, because this is basically House Bill 2020 light. In effect, what we're going to is the ESA to fund, because there's no general fund money. We all know that. The general fund money is going to go into other things besides this. So what happens right now is you have the Global Warming Commission as part of the Department of Energy. The Department of Energy, if it does get expanded, it's going to be within the Department of Energy. There's no question about it, at least in our mind. And you have this lawsuit, as we talked about earlier. You're not going to have the funds to do any of this stuff. This has to be rethought how you approach it. Your first actions earlier today with some of the bills to move some programs around were very good. We applaud that. What you do now is go into a territory where you don't know what you're going to be getting. The problem, and Mike Kaplan kind of talked about it a little bit, or alluded to it, one of you asked him a question of what happens in a way if the funds go away. And he says, we'll come back to you. That's the legislative problem. If the funds go away, if the lawsuit is successful, if basically this is a tax, which we believe it is very strongly, then they're back in your lap, and now you have this entire program set up, and now you've got to come up with the money for the program or cut it all at that point. So it doesn't really make any sense. What you need to do is spend a little bit more time. You did the good stuff, or at least you're contemplating doing some of the good stuff. But now you need to talk about governance and how we handle all this situation and where the funds are coming from. And you need to have a serious discussion of how you use tax money, whatever the source, to actually fund this kind of look-see at the environment. With that, I will close.
Any questions for Mr. Romain? Representative Holvey.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I don't totally disagree with Mr. Romain. I think there does need to be an ongoing discussion. However, I do disagree with his conclusion about the ESA being considered a tax. I think that jury is still out. And just because we're waiting for a decision about that, I don't think that should be a reason for the state not to move forward on policy. Now, if we can't foresee the future, we never can on a lot of things. If we're uncertain about the future, the idea of not taking any action just doesn't make sense to me. If Mr. Romaine's crystal ball is accurate, I'm sure the legislature would figure out how to deal with that at that point.
Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to Representative Holvey's comments about the future, Winston Churchill said, while the future may be imminent, it is still obscure.
Always is.
Ooh, smart guy.
I just want to tell you.
I know what my future looks like.
Yeah. It's a heck of a way to have a way to spend my birthday. I just want to tell you that.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday. All right. Well, you better step down before we sing, because that won't be much of a present.
Yeah, that will be really
that's an unfair card to play.
All right, thank you. Thank you, committee. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3269. And I'm adjourning the House Committee on Energy and Environment.
That's right.
The House Committee on Energy and Environment.